University of California at San Francisco, and many of you know Larry's terrific contributions to this field, and I appreciate your comments.
Thank you, Tom. The title for our session was Global Health, or had Global Health in it, and unfortunately the Fran Stillman is not with us to represent that perspective. I'm going to give you a little trip down a couple of lanes that converge, for me at least, on the issue of how system science might be the answer to a lot of the questions we've been obsessed with in recent years around the issue of translating science to practice, translating science to policy. And I take both Tom's presentation and Ken's to be parallel paths in that direction. I think the ecological approach that Ken has represented so well and the network analysis approach that Tom has represented so well give us a lot of opportunities to address these issues of bridging science and practice. And I guess because I'm supposed to be retired, I'm getting a little impatient with the pace at which we're moving on this. And so I'm getting a little bit more shrill in my my attacks on the issue. So I want to see if I can bring the subject to extending control, to the issues of extending controlled trials, which is the gold standard, as you all know, for research in our field, extending diffusion and dissemination theories and methods and practices as the core of evidence-based practice in public health, extending each of those using systems theory, network analysis, and ecological approaches as you've heard them represented. Tom's network analysis is pictorially represented often in something that looks like spider webs. systems analysis often tends to look a bit more like bowls of spaghetti, and I'll come to that. I do need to acknowledge that I receive royalties from McGraw-Hill, publishers of two textbooks related to the subject of this presentation. All right, here's the bowl of spaghetti. As it played out in from a meeting that began the group called ISIS, I think the acronym, an NCI initiative, stood for Interactive Systems in Smoking or something like that. George Richardson compiled the discussion at a meeting in November 2002, the first meeting of this group of about 20 people with global representation, particularly from Canada, the UK, and Australia, in addition to the US, about 20 people who laid out at that first meeting all the things they could think of that were really relevant and important in tobacco control. And so you see a representation of systems thinking here, not yet quite systems analysis because there are no numbers attached to these things, but it's systems thinking about the recursive arrows, the problematic causal linkages of these things because of the iterative loops and feedback loops. It represents in the coloring of the arrows in different parts of the model different subsystems. For example, the yellow arrows are the federal subsystem of tobacco control, and there are subsystems within that. The ones in the upper right-hand corner reflect federal systems of supporting tobacco control research. The ones on the left are more in the legislative arena and the regulatory arena of controlling tobacco advertising and distribution. And each of the other colors is another subsystem in the larger system. Any questions? Well, that's where we'd like to get if we can train enough people and build enough capacity to manage this kind of complexity. But let's look at the ways we have built the science of public health. The epidemiological approach of examining patterns of a disease and its spread in populations, the use of logic and common sense to understand the causes and where to intervene. It has served us very well indeed, particularly during the communicable infectious disease era when there were single causes that could be identified through epidemiological means and points of intervention that could stop the causal chain relatively simply, of course, is always relative. But John Snow's removal of the pump handle, which was attributed to, he was attributed as having been the father of epidemiology, with that simple intervention based on an epidemiological diagnosis of the pattern of cholera cases in a neighborhood of London. A second approach we've taken in public health that I think has served us very well is taking what we know about the effectiveness of individual interventions or the presumed effectiveness based on theory and combining them into programs of interventions, complex interventions to mobilize resources and community action and then to evaluate them systematically in real time. This gets us closer to systems analysis. But the hegemonic approach we have taken increasingly is a brick-by-brick building of more conclusive evidence, more certainty of the evidence, more strength of evidence on the efficacy of specific components through highly controlled randomized experimental trials. And that, because it is the gold standard, has driven the peer review process and a lot of other things, as I will illustrate presently. The NIH model, if you will, of supporting that kind of research does prove itself responsive in the short term to newly identified epidemics. Priorities are set, and in this case, the explosion of research on childhood obesity, mostly descriptive in this case, is very responsive to the pattern of recognition of the obesity epidemic in children. It looks a lot like the beginning of the diffusion curve. At about the time that Congress was hammering once again on NIH about the question of what are you doing with all this research that we have now supported for several decades in the largest research organization in the world in health. And Elias Zerhouni, who came in as director of NIH in 2002, laid out what he called the NIH Roadmap Initiative, Translating Discoveries into Health. And he emphasized T1, the movement from bench to bedside, getting basic science into practice, into controlled trials in clinical settings, clinical trials, and T2, which was to be the movement of clinical trial data on the efficacy of interventions into effectiveness trials in clinical settings. T2, however, has been relatively neglected. The roadmap, he said, identifies the most compelling opportunities in three arenas: new pathways to discovery, that's the T1 work, research teams of the future, that's the kind of transdisciplinary orientation and emphasis that Ken talked about, and re-engineering the clinical research enterprise, which we haven't quite seen how that's to play out yet. But there have been some of us who have ranted over the issue of the roadmap less traveled, T2. And not too long ago, Westfall and his colleagues published in the Journal of the American Medical Association an article called The Blue Highways on the NIH Roadmap, in which they referred to the blue highways. You know how road maps identify the interstate thoroughfares in red, and then you see blue highways branching off of those, and they wind their way through little towns, and then you get down to black lines and down to driveways if you have GIS. But we don't seem to have gotten very far on the blue highways. They suggested that we put a lot more emphasis on practice-based research as opposed to academically controlled and contrived experimental situations that has characterized T1 and most of T2. And we redefined T2 as the systematic review of these kinds of studies that move from controlled trials into practice-based settings, systematic reviews of evaluations and controlled trials in those settings, meta-analyses of these, and guideline development. And they were talking mainly in relation to clinical settings, but I think much of this applies equally to public health settings. T3, they suggested, ought to be added to the roadmap, in which we focus a lot more on dissemination research and implementation research. And I would go a step further in suggesting that we put a lot more emphasis on program evaluation, continuous quality improvement methods that have been increasingly perfected in clinical settings and we need to put to work more in public health settings, policy analysis, technical assistance in evidence-based practice adaptation. You know, there's so much emphasis in evidence-based medicine on fidelity of the application. And if we've tried the dissemination route and the implementation of evidence-based practices doesn't seem to yield the result that the trials in controlled settings suggested they should, we end up blaming the practitioner for not practicing with fidelity, with all of its moral overtones. And finally, systems research, and I'll try to develop that along the way. If we turn some of these concepts that Drs. Valente and McElroy have discussed in systems thinking, network analysis, and ecological thinking back on the research enterprise itself, we begin to ask what becomes of the research priorities as they work their way through the pipeline. Pipeline is the metaphor that NIH uses most frequently to describe the movement of research from its original foundations and investigator-initiated ideas through the pipeline to practice. Well, there are that we start with priorities for research funding, often dictated by Congress and massaged by the leadership at NIH. And then we get the peer review of grants submitted, which begin to squeeze the pipeline, and there begins to be a lot of leakage at this point of studies that don't cut it. Then we have publication priorities, peer review processes in the submission and acceptance and publication of articles, which squeezes a whole lot more. Some 46% of completed research doesn't get past this stage. Research syntheses, which are the systematic reviews, which lose a lot of their potential in the coding and cataloging of the research before it even gets funneled into systematic reviews and meta-analyses. And then there is another loss when the guidelines for evidence-based practice select a subset of all of the studies that have been cataloged and throw away a whole lot of them that don't meet the standards of the Cochrane Collaboration and other canons of acceptable designs for systematic review. And so we have, trickling out the end of this pipeline, what we offer practitioners. And it is so highly distilled, so rarefied, so pure, that practitioners find it not terribly relevant to their practice, not always a good fit for the population's practices and settings in which they're working. They are faced with a variety of funding limitations, their patients' needs or populations' needs, the demands of their patients or populations, local practice circumstances, professional discretion, and this is one that has interested me increasingly, the degree to which this whole enterprise essentially turns professionals into technicians by taking away from them most of the professional discretion, the latitudes, the degrees of freedom in deciding what is appropriate for their patients, by telling them if they don't practice exactly what the guidelines tell them without adaptation, with fidelity, then they are not good practitioners. And finally, the credibility and fit of the evidence. Now, all of this is derivative to a very large extent of the evidence-based medicine movement, which is influencing all of these other points, including the academic appointments, promotion, and tenure criteria of universities, which in turn affects the peer review and publication priorities process. And I dare say, Dr. Valenti, that you're finding that the universities aren't moving out into the community is a consequence of this very funnel. I drew the pipeline as a funnel because I wanted to feature this squeezing process. But you could also think of it as a megaphone in which we ought to be shouting up the pipeline at the research establishment. There is a quote most frequently heard on the subject of dissemination that it takes 17 years for 14% of original research to be turned into practice in the service of patient care. Now, I dare say that we would not be able to claim much better in public health, but we don't have such a statistic. And I have actually begun to map the source of that quote, the source of those two statistics, 17 years and 14%, onto this pattern of the squeezing of the pipeline. Well, Russ Glasgow talks about the law of halves. If we had some magic diet pill, only 50% of clinics might use it, 50% of the clinicians might adopt it in those clinics, 50% of patients might accept it, 50% of those would follow the regimen correctly, 50% of those would be taking, of those taking it would correctly benefit from it, and 50% of those might continue to benefit after 6 months. Now, 50% sounds a bit pessimistic, but in fact, if you look at the statistics, that's about what we get on average across large numbers of studies at each of these levels of diffusion and dissemination. So, in summary on this part of the thing, the research indicates we really should do something with all of this research. So we've approached it as a bridging the gap problem, and the gap is conceived as something like an empty vessel into which we could pour information more efficiently and get practice more productively from it. The fallacy of the empty vessel, I think, has not served us well, and I've come to something of a conclusion that the problem probably is not dissemination anymore, if it ever was. We are so efficient in disseminating so much information that most practitioners are totally overwhelmed by it, and it is now really much more a problem of implementation. Well, the NIH really got going on this issue, and particularly under the leadership of John Kerner and a few others at NCI, in putting out requests for proposals to really address these issues very directly. But there were two problems, I felt, with their framing of the issue. They used the term research-tested interventions. Are they and my question is, are those appropriate for all the reasons I've just suggested? Are they appropriate to other settings and populations, which is the external validity issue that has been sacrificed in the single-minded, blinded obsession with internal validity in the peer review process? To illustrate the first problem, the Canadian Cancer Society put out an RFP for a review to answer four questions. They were prepared to take to scale what we should have known by then, they felt, must know, since there had been by then about 3,000 randomized controlled studies in the literature on smoking cessation. The four questions you can see here: are group counseling programs effective? If so, what's the optimal content? What's the optimal number and frequency of sessions? And what's the characteristics of the most effective facilitators? The grant, the contract was won by Steve Mansky and Roy Cameron and others at the University of Waterloo, and they came to the following conclusions: a comprehensive literature review of over 40 years of published and unpublished studies found the usual deficiencies in purpose, design, and reporting, but they concluded that the research could only answer the first of the four questions, that group programs for smoking cessation are effective. So I think that makes the case that what we're producing for practitioners is not answering the questions they really need answered. I think this is the consequence of the evidence-based movement taken to scale in general practice and health promotion. And I think we've got to be a lot more critical of what parts of evidence-based medicine and its canons and grading of evidence are most appropriate and relevant to public health. The peer review preferences for experimental control and certainty of causation. The publishing preferences for randomized controlled trials and positive results. The limitations of print space, driving out richer description of interventions, protocols, procedural lessons, and subgroup variations. All the things that practitioners most want to know about are the things that editors say, we don't have space for that in the articles. And I'll conclude with something approaching the systems thinking ideal that could at least be the intermediate step we give much more emphasis to. It's a more natural type of practice-based evidence that has greater influence on multi-level program planning, practice, and policy, more likely to influence others like those who experience the programs that are out there. In the U.S., in the late 80s and early 90s, we were chugging along at about 1.5% per year in all 50 states in the reduction in consumption of cigarettes, of tobacco. The same for California, the same for Massachusetts. California passed a law in 1988 that raised the taxes on cigarettes and devoted a fair proportion of that tax to a comprehensive tobacco control program. The other 48 states continued at about the 1.5% per year. California doubled the rate of reduction in the next 2 years after they got their program rolling. Massachusetts held steady with the other 48 states. From 1992 to 96, Massachusetts passed an even higher tax on cigarettes and devoted an even larger percentage of it to a comprehensive tobacco control program. The other 48 states continued at the same rate. California had now hit its stride with its comprehensive tobacco control program and has now tripled the rate of the other 48 states. Massachusetts quadrupled the rate of the other 48 states. Now that was compelling evidence for the other 48 states, and they wanted to know what California and Massachusetts did. And they were quick to say, we're not California and we're not Massachusetts, but they were interested in what happened in this real life, real time, with real people program. And so I was heading the Office of Smoking and Health at this point, and we put these together, the experiences of California and Massachusetts, in a document called Best Practices for Comprehensive Tobacco Control Programs. Now, this has become one of the bestsellers, the all-time bestsellers of CDC, because it represented best practices as that which we can find in real time in real places. And I leave you with the thought that if we want more evidence-based practice, we need more practice-based evidence. Thank you.